From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, business is booming for Michigan's auto industry, right now anyway, but what happens if there's another downturn? Are the automakers really better prepared to weather it? A new report offers some answers.
Don't expect this to be a continuous growth period where we're just going to keep asking for more and more cars. Things are probably going to start slowing down.
Then, should you vote yes or no on Michigan's Proposal 1? Turns out it's a really complicated question.
Probably not the best drafted language that I've ever seen. Probably could be improved to give voters full information on what they're voting on.
And hey, we get to meet NPR's new chief executive, Yarl Mohn. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Michigan's primary elections are on Tuesday, and one of the things you'll be looking at is Proposal 1. Basically, it asks voters to approve a tax policy change, but you probably wouldn't figure that out from reading its actual language. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we'll sort out what Prop 1 is all about before you hit the voting booth. Then later in the hour, the new NPR president, Yarl Mohn, is here. We'll talk with him about what's next for the network. But first, when the economy in Michigan is hurting, you always hear politicians talking about diversifying the economy. And a lot of news articles and news columns talk about the need to be less reliant on auto manufacturing. But when the auto industry is doing better and the economy in Michigan is riding along with it, that talk kind of disappears. Well, not this time. Rick Haglin recently wrote about a report that indicates the auto industry soon might be hitting the brakes. Rick joins us now. He's a freelance journalist and contributor to Bridge Magazine, M Live, and others. Rick, nice to talk to you again.
Good to be with you, Lester.
And also joining us is auto reporter for Michigan Radio, Tracy Samilton. Hi, Tracy.
Hi there.
So this Michigan economic roller coaster might be peaking, according to this report you wrote about, Rick. Who put together that report, and what does it say?
Well, the report was put together by a corporate turnaround and restructuring firm called Alex Partners. They're a very respected firm that was founded by Jay Alex, who was well known in this area for corporate turnarounds. He was involved in Kmart, many of the ones nationally, and also had some involvement in General Motors bankruptcy. He's no longer active in the firm, but the firm is still going strong and put out quite an interesting report a couple of weeks ago that basically said that, you know, we might be hitting another peak in the auto industry. There were quite a few reasons cited for this. One of them is that they're predicting that interest rates could rise a bit next year, which could slow auto sales. Another one has to do with the fact that more young people appear not to be as interested in purchasing cars these days for whatever reason, whether they're not interested or they can't financially, but their sales have been spotty. And plus, there's a lot of global problems going on, and the auto industry in Michigan is very sensitive to those kinds of things.
Well, let's start with how well is the auto industry doing right now? Tracy, what do the numbers tell us?
They're doing very well. The suppliers are, to the automotive industries are getting a lot of orders. The car companies themselves, if we just look at General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, well, let's look at Ford first. Ford's probably going to make a profit of maybe $7 billion this year. General Motors would have made about the same amount of money had it not been for the recall crisis. Chrysler making a little less because it's a smaller company, but their business really is booming right now. And what this report says is don't expect this to be a continuous growth period where we're just going to keep asking for more and more cars. Things are probably going to start slowing down.
Yeah, Rick, your report mentioned certain numbers of vehicles being sold and what we could expect if there is a downturn. What did it show?
Well, I think this year many of the analysts are expecting about 16.3, 16.4 million vehicles to be sold. That's getting close to the record 17 million that were sold about a decade or so ago. And Alex Partners says that could drop to somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 million by 2019. That's not a huge drop, but any drop of a million or so vehicles is somewhat significant and worrisome.
So, Tracy, if there's a downturn, are the automakers better prepared to weather it?
By far, yeah. The last recession taught them a lot. They faced, you know, the end of their existence. In the case of General Motors and Chrysler, there was a huge amount of downsizing that happened prior to 2008 and certainly after 2008. At this point, the auto companies can probably break even or make a profit when at a rate of only about 10 or 11 million vehicles, and we don't see going back down to that point. So they will continue to make money. It's just that they will make less.
So the auto industry seems like it'll be doing okay, but what about Michigan? How reliant are we still on the auto industry? Rick, has Michigan been able to attract other kinds of industries to work toward diversifying the economy?
Well, that doesn't seem to be a big priority at the moment, and I guess the question is can state government really diversify the economy? What can they do to attract different kinds of industries? One of the criticisms that I hear from economists about Michigan's ability to do that is that we just do not have a very well-educated workforce. So we can't attract a lot of these knowledge-type industries to come to Michigan. Not to say that the auto industry isn't a knowledge industry. It has a lot of knowledge jobs, but we have one of the lower rates of educational attainment in the country. I think we rank around 36th in terms of the percentage of people who have a bachelor's degree in the state.
Yeah, it's ironic too, because we attract people from around the world for our education system. People come here to be educated.
And then leave.
Yeah. And then leave.
You know, I want to get into the politics of this just a little bit. Rick, you mentioned something about the rainy day fund in the state of Michigan. The state government rainy day fund is not nearly as big now as it was prior to the previous recession. And we still haven't done anything about the roads. Could Michigan be facing an even worse time if we have a long-term downturn like could happen?
Well, it could. It's interesting. Back in 2000, we had $1.3 billion in the rainy day fund. That was the high point. All of that money got used up in just 3 years. We depleted that fund by the end of 2003, and we went through the whole decade with basically no rainy day fund. One of the things that's a little worrisome right now is we've got less money in the rainy day fund than we had before. I think it's around $500 million. And if you look at the buying power needed to duplicate that $1.3 billion, we'd need $1.8 billion when you take inflation into account. So we're far short of that. Plus, we've enacted a tax system that's more sensitive than the up and downs of the auto industry than it used to be, because we've implemented this 6% corporate income tax. So companies don't pay any tax when
well,
they don't.
The governor and the legislature say, you know, that's going to draw business to us. Have we seen much of that? I know in some studies it indicates that the economy has improved, and it may be because of our tax structure now versus 3 years ago. What are we seeing, and has that helped us diversify the economy any?
Well, the economy obviously has improved, and a lot of that has to do with the improvement in the auto industry. But this new business tax structure is bringing in far less tax revenues than the old structure did, which taxed a variety of things, including payroll and gross receipts. We've got less money in state government to put into initiatives to prepare for the future.
So what I hear you both saying is we're not prepared for a downturn at all. If we get hit again, it's going to be tough.
I think if our tax revenues drop again, it's going to be really tough because there's so many areas that we've disinvested in. We've disinvested in education and inroads, many other things that attract people to live here. So I think it's that cumulative effect of not putting the investment in when we needed to that is going to place us in a vulnerable situation. Now, from my perspective, I do think what the Snyder administration is trying to do in terms of cutting the red tape down, making the state officials say, hey, we're there with you. We'll go to Germany if you want, you German auto parts supplier, want to come here. We will make it easy for you. I think that is a very, very important initiative, and maybe we're starting to see some fruit from that there. We just had Indian auto supplier Mahindra locate in Ann Arbor, and we're seeing some of this happen. So there are things you can do as a state without money, but you know, in the end run, you know, you cannot fix the roads without money.
Sounds like the only thing I'm hearing here that sounds really good is the automakers won't go bankrupt again if we have a downturn. That's the only good news I'm pulling out of this.
I think there's more than that, Lester, in terms of the changes in the auto industry. There really is a big opportunity for us if we can use our money wisely to make Michigan stronger in terms of the auto industry. You know, I just feel like it's a lot easier to make what you have more effective than try and go out and do something new. We have a strong industry right now that needs to build more fuel-efficient cars, that needs to build connected vehicles in the future, and there are huge opportunities there. There's a report that recently came out and said, if we do the right things, there could be another 100,000 jobs coming to Michigan, but it's if we do the right things part that's the hard part.
That's auto reporter for Michigan Radio, Tracy Samilton. Also joining us on the line was Rick Haglin. He's a freelance journalist and contributor to Bridge Magazine, MLive, and others. Nice to talk to both of you.
It was great to be here.
Good to talk to you, too.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. This year, we've heard more about soccer than maybe ever in the U.S. More than 26 million people in the U.S. watched the World Cup in Brazil, so it got a lot of attention, and we're just about to get hit with more soccer here in Michigan. Two of the biggest teams in professional soccer are going to be playing in the big house at the University of Michigan. Manchester United and Real Madrid will be playing on August 2nd in Ann Arbor. Joining me now is Andy Markovitz. He teaches political science at the University of Michigan and has written widely about soccer. So tell me, why has this happened? These two big European teams coming here, why are they playing here?
Oh, it has everything to do with marketing. These are global brands. Manchester United was just wooed away from Nike by Adidas for a 10-year contract, which I think exceeds over $1 billion. It represents General Motors. I mean, these are global brands, and they're playing for the brand. That's why you have them here. And I'm, of course, absolutely ecstatic to see in my lifetime my beloved Manchester United playing on my beloved big house. I mean, this is a dream.
Best of two worlds coming together for you.
Unbelievable. These two worlds really of holy proportion, adoring both, and these two different cultures, different languages actually meeting in this one ground. So it's amazing.
So with the World Cup and all the excitement about it, do you think it's made a real shift in U.S. interest in soccer?
It's a gradual shift, and the shift has been going on since actually the 1970s and then with an additional gear in the 1990s, and this is another gear. But there's a huge difference between World Cup and soccer. Millions of Americans follow the World Cup, and that does not mean that they follow the New York Red Bulls playing against New England or the San Jose Earthquakes or the New England Revolution. I mean, those are two different things, although they're related. And no question, soccer has gained immense popularity in the United States, even though the World Cup within that has an extra space which regular soccer does not have.
There's speculation that this might set attendance records for a soccer match in the U.S. We all know Michigan Stadium's big enough, but are there enough fans to break a record?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really expecting 109,000.
Oh, pack it then.
Yeah. This is like the Winter Classic, which I attended as well. And these are really Michigan, by the way, a hockey, of course.
Yeah, that's a hockey game this
year. Between the Red Wings and the Toronto Maple Leafs. Obviously for clearly commercial reasons, but one should also not forget that this gives the University of Michigan a global forum, which is second to none. I mean, you know, everybody in Europe is writing me, and this is a huge thing that these two mega clubs are playing at the University of Michigan.
Manchester United and Real Madrid will play on August 2nd at the Big House at the University of Michigan. Thanks very much, Andy Markovitz. Appreciate the time, and good luck to your team.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The War of 1812 is famous for the Star-Spangled Banner. It's famous for Oliver H. Perry's "We have met the enemy and they are ours." But really, not a lot of people know much about that war. Michigan and the Great Lakes were key battle sites between the fledgling United States and the British. The River Raisin near Monroe, Michigan was a site of a major battle. And on August 4th, we will mark the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Mackinac Island. Joining us now is museum historian for the Mackinac State Historic Parks, Craig Wilson. Hi there. How are you?
Good. How are you?
So let's start with the basics. Why was Mackinac Island an important strategic site worth fighting for during the war?
Well, it's important to remember that Mackinac Island was kind of the center of the Upper Great Lakes. It had a very important role to play in the fur trade, which really drove the economy of the entire region. But maybe more importantly, both the Americans and the British realized that whoever controlled Mackinac Island had at least some influence amongst the Native American people of the Great Lakes. And that's really what drove their interest in it, is both this economic reason as well as trying to be able to interact with those Native people.
I understand the British seized Mackinac Island before the Americans who were there even knew the war had been declared. So this battle we're commemorating was a couple of years later as the Americans fought to take it back. How entrenched were the British at that point?
They were pretty well prepared for anything that was coming. They had been expecting the Americans. The Americans had been trying to get back into Michigan and back up to Mackinac really since the beginning of the war. You mentioned the River Raisin early in 1813. That's one of the first American attempts to come back and retake the Michigan territory. It just took a while for it actually to happen, for the Americans to get up to Mackinac. The British commander of Fort Mackinac, a man named Lieutenant Colonel Robert McDowell, he actually arrived and took command of the fort early in the spring of 1814. He brought some reinforcements with him, and he immediately put his men to work strengthening the defenses of Fort Mackinac and actually building an entire second fort on Mackinac Island. They called it Fort George. So they knew the Americans were coming. It was just a matter of when.
How successful were the Americans in trying to take back Mackinac Island?
Not at all. It was a pretty massive expedition. They sent the Lake Erie fleet, so ships that were famous from Perry's victory at the Battle of Lake Erie in 1813. So seven warships, about 750 soldiers. It was a pretty massive expedition that lasted well over 2 months. It included naval bombardments. It included an amphibious landing and the actual battle on Mackinac Island, as well as a naval blockade, and the British were able to overcome and defeat all of that. So Mackinac Island remained safely in British hands despite all of these American efforts.
So when you walk around on Mackinac Island today, how much of the fort is original? Where are some of the battlegrounds on Mackinac Island?
All of Fort Mackinac is original. Nothing there has been reconstructed. Unfortunately, there's not a lot left from the 1812 period, simply because those buildings would have been replaced historically. When you visit Fort Mackinac today, the walls, the big stone walls that you can see from the harbor, from the backside of the fort, the cannon platforms, as well as the officers' stone quarters would have all been there in 1812. The other buildings are just as historic. The newest building we have over there is from 1885, but again, they were built after the war. In terms of the rest of Mackinac Island, the battlefield itself from 1814 is now the Wawashkamo Golf Course. Many of the landscape features that the soldiers encountered 200 years ago are still there, and they've been incorporated into the course. Other places on the island include Fort George, that second fort that the British built. It's called Fort Holmes now. There's some original earthworks up there, and Mackinac State Historic Parks is actually in the process of rehabilitating and reconstructing that fort. So over the next several months here, there will actually be another fort on Mackinac Island.
How are you guys presenting the Mackinac Island history and commemorating this battle?
There's a couple of different ways. We have some permanent exhibits at Fort Mackinac. We have, as part of our daily interpretive programming, a few times a day, our interpretive staff actually changes into the uniforms of some of the British soldiers that were stationed at the fort during the war, and they have a whole slate of programs talking about that. But our big commemoration is actually going to be August 1st through the 4th. We're bringing in just under 200 participants, living historians, reenactors, musical groups, really from all over the Great Lakes and Canada. And we're going to be presenting an entire weekend of events. There'll be special demonstrations and tours at Fort Mackinac every day. We're doing bike tours of war-related sites on Mackinac Island. So, for instance, we'll go up to Fort Holmes. We'll visit the battlefield. We'll visit British Landing, where the British came ashore in 1812 and where the Americans attempted to come ashore in 1814. The reconstructed brig Niagara will be visiting the island. They're going to be offering tours throughout the weekend, so people will get a chance to actually go aboard a reconstruction of one of the original warships. And then the main event is actually on August 4th, on Monday, and that's going to be basically a ceremony recreating the battle. Almost 200 years down to the hour, we'll be out on the original battlefield. We'll have all of these volunteers participating there, and it should give people at least some sense of how the action actually would have played out back in 1814.
That sounds great. At least maybe Michiganders will walk away with a little better idea of what their state flag stands for.
Right, right.
All right, thanks very much. We've been talking to museum historian for the Mackinac State Historic Parks, Craig Wilson. Craig, thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
My failure. My failure. My divorce. My
failure. I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
And now, another story of failure. This time from Failure Lab Detroit. Here's Charlie Wahlberg.
Start. Stumble. Facepalm. Learn. Grow. Experiment. Fail. Start again. Adapt. Still fail. Bang your head against something hard. Persevere. Adapt. Fail again. Cry. Drink. Watch late night infomercials. Briefly consider a job working from home, earning $10,000 in your spare time. Dust yourself off. Jump back in. Fail. Fail faster. Fail again. Succeed. Celebrate. Be labeled overnight success. Secretly flip off everyone who calls you overnight success. Punch back in and fail again. Iterate and fail. Repeat and fail. Succeed. Failure is a step. It's not the destination. Failure comes first and hopefully not last. If I look at my life as a failure, I really am well-versed. From falling upstairs and falling down, sold my Apple stock at 20, wore white after Labor Day. No matter how you look at it, as a business owner, I've really had some remarkable things. And in the pop culture and fashion magazines, the last few pages, they always black out someone's eye and they say, they're doing it wrong, or I can't believe they wore this. If business magazines had that, it'd be like, area entrepreneur, up again. Whether it be funding or finance or hiring or firing, AP, AR, HR, CYA, I have screwed the pooch in just about every facet of a business there is to. But I'm always trying to be this heretic, trying to help people innovate. And as a creative director, I get to go in companies and I upset the apple cart and I light fires, and it's so much fun. And then you look at your own life and you realize the most in need of kicking is right behind you. You know, if I could ever walk into my own office and just go to a whiteboard and say, let's look at everything you're doing wrong, because really, there is no shortage. You know, we hide behind the cobbler's children never have no shoes. That's such a excuse, isn't it? But it's not a fear of failure that really is my bugaboo. It's comfort. It's complacency. It's having a little bit of success and then kind of plateauing. And, you know, to kind of look at it from a couple of specific examples, starting in my career in advertising, I worked for big firms and little firms and, you know, was kicked out of just about everywhere as a writer, a designer, a coder, a creative director, a strategist. Didn't matter what I was doing. Didn't last long. And I finally found an agency where I really, you know, felt I could grow. And I was there for a few years and moved through the ranks quickly and got my own department and really got to fly over the country just coming up with crazy ideas and upsetting the apple cart. And it was so great. But I still always had this dream of wanting to have my own agency. Well, you know, first I wanted to be a jingle writer. You know, music to me as a child was get on the right track to 9 Mile and Mac, or here, dog, come on, dog, man, dog, I want you all to calm down to Telegraph Road. Get a good deal. So that was my first advertising dream. Didn't work out so well. But, you know, I wanted to have this agency. So while I'm working for the 8th biggest marketing firm in the world, and I'm having a ball, but I still start my own company. And I'm like, you know, I am going to start the coolest agency in the world. But then you get your paycheck and your expense check and your flying around and like, this is nice. They're velvet handcuffs, which is very popular in some circles. So I never go. I never do it because I'm comfortable. I'm successful enough. And go through a few different regime changes at the agency, and a new executive vice president comes in and she calls me into her office and sits me down. And this is a quote. She's like, Charlie, we love your enthusiasm. We love all the big ideas. But really what we want you to do is come up with new ideas we've done before. So right there is like, that's the world screaming, Charlie, here's your chance. Go live your dream. But the paycheck comes. And I just kind of waste away in the corner, waiting. And 9/11 happens. And here come the cuts in all the business offices. And suddenly, I'm a reluctant entrepreneur. It took someone else to make me the entrepreneur. But I learned my lesson now. So we get the company, and me and a couple partners. I'm full-time. They're still working where they work. And in a year, you know, I've gotten back to where I'm making a good living again. Things are nice. And complacency sets in again. Until my two partners get kicked out the door. And suddenly there's 3 mouths to feed. And you know what? Accidentally, we grow the accounts. We get more work. Company slowly grows up to about 10 people. Then 2008 hits. And complacency doesn't really mean comfort here, because now we're not making money. We're fighting all the time about this is the right way, this is the right way. And we are miserable and we're at each other's throats. But still, I can't leave. This is my home. This is my agency. And so we fight and we're miserable. Until one of our clients saves the day by saying, I either want to buy you or I'd like to join the firm. And they look at the books and say, yeah, I'm not doing that. So it took, again, an outside influence to break up what wasn't working and move me out. So then another restart a couple years ago. And so got back up, took me some time, got back to where I was. And again, that plateau that looks an awful lot more like a couch.
That was Charlie Wahlberg telling his story of failure. You can find out more about Failure Lab and hear more stories at failure-lab.com. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. So primary election is on August 5th, and one of the things you'll be looking at is Proposition 1. It asks voters to approve a tax policy change, but the darn thing is really confusing. To help us clear this up a little bit is Bob Schneider with Citizens Research Council of Michigan. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit group that objectively analyzes policy issues like this. So, Bob, let's start at the beginning. The state has long had a thing called the personal property tax. What is the PPT?
The personal property tax is an annual property tax. You and I pay property tax on our homes. Businesses pay that same property tax on personal property, and that's the stuff that's in that's in their businesses: computers, office furniture, equipment and machinery, tools. And the business community sees this as a particularly onerous tax. It's a tax on productive assets that they use to make goods.
So you buy something and you keep paying taxes on it every year afterwards. So the legislature passed a bill and the governor signed saying that we're going to get rid of this, right?
Correct. That was in 2012. Legislature enacted legislation to exempt businesses from that personal property tax. The legislature sees this. The governor sees it as a inducement to encourage more investment, more business expansion, and then hopefully more jobs in the business community.
So how much money, how much revenue for the state is lost in this tax cut or tax exemption?
Well, this is a phased-in exemption, so the revenue needed to reimburse local governments, because that's the issue here, is when we eliminate the personal property tax, local governments depend on that revenue, some very much. So they will begin to lose that revenue. The state is going to kick in revenue from the state's use tax to help make up for those local losses. Fiscal year 2016, we're talking $100 million. That's going to grow fairly rapidly. Eventually, 10 years down the road, the state general fund will lose roughly $500 million in revenue.
So I want to get to the use tax, as you mentioned. I also want to get to this assessment on equipment that we've not yet talked about. But how will the state go about helping these municipalities help up for this loss through this assessment, through this use tax?
A portion. So we pay this use tax now on, as we said, online purchases and catalog purchases, phone bills. And a portion of that revenue is going to be converted to a new local tax. And that local tax revenue, it's called the Local Community Stabilization Share Tax. A portion of that all of that revenue will go to reimburse local governments for their personal property tax exemption losses.
So we're shifting an existing tax from the general fund to municipalities.
Exactly, exactly. And that's expected on the whole to hold local governments harmless from the personal property tax exemption losses. Now, from a unit-by-unit basis, that may not be true. We're going to find some local governments that may get under-reimbursed. We're going to find some local governments that may actually get over-reimbursed. But on the whole, it's expected to the revenue should be sufficient to reimburse local governments for all their losses.
Okay, so let's go back to those businesses that are paying this personal property tax. That's exempted now. But then they put an assessment in place so that they are actually taxing businesses again at a much lower level. Why is that necessary?
It's necessary because the revenue from that new state essential services assessment will help mitigate some of these general fund costs that we just talked about. When this legislation was first enacted in 2012, the reimbursement that was proposed at that time didn't completely cover local government losses. It left local governments not whole on the average. In order to boost that reimbursement, they needed more revenue. And this state essential services assessment is essentially the means to get that additional revenue. So effectively, businesses that are paying the personal property tax now, maybe 35 mills at a local level, are going to pay a smaller state essential services assessment. They'll probably get about a 85 or 90% tax cut. but they'll still be paying a little bit, and that'll be to make up the difference from the old reimbursement plan that didn't hold local governments completely harmless to the new plan that does.
So we've got a tax cut for businesses that used to go to municipalities. That municipal money, that local government money, will still come in, although varying amounts for different governments, it sounds like. Nobody's taxes are being raised in this Proposition 1. Am I right so far?
That's correct.
So why is this going to the voters?
It's a great question. The legislature enacts legislation all the time, and it's incredibly rare for them to decide, hey, we want the local voters to vote on this and approve what we just approved. There isn't anywhere that you can point to that explains the legislature's rationale for putting this to a statewide vote. Our own analysis and interpretation of this is a constitutional issue. We have a proposal that will create a new local tax. That local tax will be levied by a new local but statewide authority. So you have a local unit of government levying a new local tax. And the Headley provisions of the Constitution that state voters approved in 1978 require a vote of the people to authorize any new or increased local tax. So this is coming out of an existing tax, a state tax, but it is a new local tax. And without voter approval for the new local tax, that would open up the whole reimbursement process, the new local tax that's used to facilitate that, to legal challenges. And I think that explains the vote. We need a Headley authorization vote for this new local tax.
So that's because of the Headley Amendment. Now, I've been reading a lot of stories about Prop 1, and I've been reading a lot of the comments. I know you're not supposed to read the comments. They'll drive you crazy. But I read the comments, and people are really suspicious that this proposition is being voted on during a primary election. They say if they're doing it during a primary election, that means they're up to something. Why are we putting this vote for Prop 1 on during a primary election?
Well, I suspect, there's no organized opposition to Proposal 1. The legislature passed these personal property tax exemptions and the reimbursement provisions that are relevant to Proposal 1. The legislature drafted the language that's going to appear on the ballot and appeared right in the legislation that authorized these changes. And I suspect that the August primary, in the minds of those who are proponents for personal property tax reform and local reimbursement, feel that the August primary, somewhat smaller turnout and a different turnout, gives it a better chance to succeed on the ballot.
My colleague Jack Lessenberry said that the language of this ballot proposal he's a college professor and he had a hard time understanding it. I think the average voter is going to look at this and say, I have no idea what this is. I'm just going to vote no. Why is the language so confusing?
Well, as I read, the legislature drafted this language.
Well, that says a lot right there.
The ballot language that you will see before you on August 5th is right from the legislation that authorized all of these changes. It appears, I think, as I read it, it looks to be structured to sort of encourage recognition of the positives. It talks about modernizing the tax system, reimbursing and providing revenues to local governments. I would agree with Jack and with others who have said it's probably not the best drafted language that I've ever seen, and probably could be improved to give voters, full information on what they're voting on. But that ballot language does come right from the legislation.
So give me a sample of who's in favor of a yes vote for Proposition 1.
Well, almost no groups are saying vote no, at least organized groups. The state business community is fully on board. The state chamber, I suspect almost all local chambers of commerce. The local governments are throwing their support behind it. I suspect they're very worried about, well, if this fails and the governor and the legislature have said personal property tax reform is a key priority for us, that it's going to pass, but this time it's going to pass without the reimbursement that's tied to this proposal. I've seen union endorsements for this, particularly unions that represent local government employees. So a lot of backers, no organized opposition, as far as I have seen.
Yeah, I even saw the AARP had spoken out in favor of the
proposal. I did see that as well, correct.
So to my mind, there's a lot of confusion about this proposition that really should have been made clear a long time ago. Everybody seems to be in favor, or the vast majority of people seem to be in favor, yet I can just imagine on primary election day, a lot of people looking at this and saying, I don't get it. It sounds like a new tax to me. I'm voting no against any new tax. Are the organizers behind this effort concerned about that?
Oh, I think they're very concerned. And I've seen some polling that shows that, it's sort of a mixed yes-no vote right now. I think folks are very concerned. The language is a bit confusing. A lot of money is going to be spent here in the next couple weeks to try to push for a yes vote on this from the backers. But it does not look like it's the slam dunk that some thought it might be several months ago.
That's Bob Schneider with Citizens Research Council of Michigan explaining Proposition 1, which will appear on the August 5th ballot. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you so much.
So all of that explanation about Prop 1, and I still have some questions, sort of legislative insight or legislative history questions. So here's Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta. Rick, number one, what happens if Prop 1 fails? Will the personal property tax exemption still take effect and the local governments just lose out?
No. What happens is if Prop 1 fails, then Michigan just reverts back to the system that the legislature just scrapped. Businesses, the small businesses that basically have property that's worth less than $80,000, they can claim their exemption for 2014, but then they go back to paying the tax in 2015. And a lot of the larger businesses, big manufacturers, resume their frustration with the personal property tax on their equipment.
And if Prop 1 wins and the taxes that are to be shifted to local government happens, can future legislatures decide to cut that funding to the municipalities?
Oh, absolutely. That, as a matter of fact, it is in the state constitution that no legislature can lock in a future legislature. You cannot make promises on behalf of a future legislature that a law will never be changed. And so if, say 10 years from now, the legislature is looking at a budget issue and half a billion dollars that's going to local governments rather than to the state's general fund, they can turn around, they can change the law and say, we need that for our purposes. There's nothing stopping them from doing that.
So the only guarantee for municipalities is that portion of revenue sharing, which is solid in the Constitution.
Yes. And of course, that is the crux of the complexity of Proposal 1, because this is a solution rooted in suspicion that local governments said, look, just eliminating the personal property tax and promising us that we won't lose money on the deal, that's not enough. We have a history here. We have a history of revenue sharing, the statutory part of it, the part that's not locked in by the Constitution, of you guys just taking that money that was supposed to come to us and diverting it. And so your promises are no good here. We need more. And as a matter of fact, what they originally wanted was an amendment to the state constitution guaranteeing that. And on the street, this is called extortion, but in Lansing, it's called negotiation. That the Republican leaders came back and said, well, we could eliminate the personal property tax and all that revenue to you and not replace it at all. And so the local government said, okay, we'll take that. Let's do a law. Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much, Rick. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Lester.
That's Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta at the Capitol.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. NPR has a new president, and he's visiting us here today. Jarl Mohn, welcome to Michigan Radio. Thanks for coming by.
Great to be here.
So I have to ask you this. You managed MTV, VH1, you chaired CNET, you created E!, as well as worked with several other media outlets. How in the world did you end up on your resume with the letters NPR?
Well, in the last 12 years in L.A., when I was doing venture capital investing, I got involved in a number of not-for-profit organizations, one of which was Southern California Public Radio, KPCC, and kind of rekindled my love for radio. The first 19 years of my career were in radio, commercial radio, but I've really enjoyed public radio immensely. So the opportunity came up. I didn't really want to go back to work in a traditional sense. This is the only thing on the planet that I would have gone back to work for.
You know, you mentioned your commercial radio experience. You've been a disc jockey, a programmer, a general manager. You've owned commercial radio stations. I worked in commercial radio station at a time. You did better than I, apparently. So what can public radio learn from the commercial radio world? I mean, they do know how to make money.
Yes. And I think that's probably been the one area that public radio has not excelled in. Public radio has done a great job in building an audience. And not just building an audience, but building a really loyal audience of people that matter, people that are very engaged, people that are very connected with their communities. Public radio, NPR, has not done a good job turning that into a really solid business model. And I think that's what I hope to bring to the company.
Well, you have a lot of passionate people who have mission in mind, but mission and money don't always go together that well.
Well, I heard the phrase on my little tour across America this week, which I thought was great: no money, no mission.
Right. You are the fifth NPR president in 8 years. So what do you think NPR staff and the stations around the nation want or need from you?
Well, the first is they want stability. Mm. And I've committed to a 5-year tenure minimum. And then I'll stay longer if everybody makes it fun for me. That's one. I do think people now are very focused on and aware of the importance that we have a good business. I think most people know we've delivered on content and have a very loyal audience and a really valuable audience. The organization has not been particularly run well for a long period of time. Some of my predecessors have actually started to move the organization in the right direction and did some really great and made some very good moves, but weren't there long enough to see them through. So I think the organization will be a beneficiary, as I will, of some of the things that have started to be put in place over the last 2 years. We want to make sure the people that are doing the work now continue to do it and are able to do it at a better and higher level because they've got the tools that they need. It doesn't mean anything else. The content's been miraculous. It's been wonderful. It's been magical. It's not the business side of the business hasn't been run particularly well.
All right, here's the tough question that the executive producer has told me I must ask you.
Uh-oh.
What's your favorite NPR show?
I don't answer that one.
Dodging.
No, I am.
I'm
totally
looking at her.
I
She's yelling and jumping up and down in there. She's really upset.
I am. I do have a favorite one, but I'm not going to say.
That might be smart in the long run. Jarl Mohn is the new NPR president. Thanks for stopping by and talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ali Billings. Stateside executive producer is Zoe Clark. The program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.